This is Alan Precious and Julian Taylor, recorded together at Sanford in Cumbria by Chris Eldon Lee on the 28th of October 2010. Alan Precious and Julian Taylor, Part 1.
Alan Precious, 11th March 1926.
Where?
Eskrick, York, New York.
So these days you're now...
84.
You didn't look it.
You shouldn't say things like that.
I'm sorry. And what was your first inkling of the Antarctic? Can you remember your first contact?
My first interest, I think I'd heard about Scott and so on as a schoolboy, but my first real interest began when I was a soldier in Palestine, and we had a library which someone or other looked after and changed books every now and then. And one of these books that I picked up was Edward Wilson's, one of his books, which I read, and later on I got a copy of it. And it was very interesting to me, his life and the Antarctic. Mm. And never thought I would go there myself.
What turned the I'll never get there into the reality of being able to get there?
This happened, I was working in Harrogate in the Post Office Savings Bank, and reading the Daily Express one day, or one paper like that, there's an advertisement calling for young men to go to the Falkland Islands dependencies as meteorologists. I think it said that. And so I wrote off a letter applying. I wasn't a meteorologist, but I was always very interested in the weather. I'd been skiing in Norway and in North Yorkshire and done a bit of elementary rock climbing. And from the advertisement, it looked to me as though the Antarctic wasn't mentioned. And it looked to me as though it was islands around the Falklands where a dozen or less young men, dozen or fewer young men, made weather observations and spent the rest of their time looking after themselves, cooking and so on. And, somewhere or other it said there was a good library of books. So that appealed to me.
So you applied?
I applied, yes.
And got an interview?
I got an interview. And I went to London, interviewed by three people, one of whom I think was Frank Elliott. I am not sure who the other two people were, but it was connected, of course, with the Crown agents. And so presumably at least one of these people was from the Crown agents. Had the interview, went home, forgot all about it. And suddenly one day, I think my boss at the savings bank received a telegram asking if Precious still wanted to go or something like that. And I said yes. And I was given leave on approved employment. Which meant that they'd got rid of me for a period and I could come back.
So they wanted you back?
Yes, because I hadn't resigned and they hadn't sacked me.
Right. Julian, let's turn to you. So if you'd like to give me your name, place and date of birth.
My name is Julian Taylor. I'm younger than Alan. I think it's 21st of June 1929. I was born at Chumman on the Pakistan-Afghan border, where my parents were doctors.
Did you live for a long time there, or did you come home more or less straight away?
We were in what was in until the six, and I was sent home to boarding school, like kids were from the Empire.
And what was your first inkling that there might be a place called the Antarctic?
Clearly, about 15, 16, I was completely turned on by Gino Watkins's book, written by Scott, the other Scott. And I read that avidly when I was 15, 16. And clearly, I was brought up in the Lake District. I was rock climbing rather badly and things. So it was a fairly natural thing for me to think about the Antarctic.
Were you sailing? In the lakes, were you sailing?
Fell walking, with a hunt, sailing a little bit. We were latter day, my mother was a doctor. We were just allowed to roam the hills. Four of us kids just roamed wildly.
Did you make any effort to get to the Antarctic, or did it happen by accident?
Then I went in the army, obviously, and I was a pretty disgraceful soldier, but I did get my red berry. But was it 2 and 6 a day or 2 and 6 a week?
I think it was certainly an extra 2 and 6 that we got, yes.
And then, obviously, university. I was climbing adequately well. And then I can't remember quite how, but they wanted a person to change the food. And I used to go to the Scott Polar for lectures, and as you know in my memo, I was interviewed by Bunny Fuchs the day before.
Yes.
Who said, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm off to the Antarctic. And he said, I'm interviewing you tomorrow.
Did he admire your spunk?
He was a very nice man. He and Ray Ady were very good to me that summer term. They let me darky, Ray Ady let me his dog whip. I was allowed to take Bunny's dog on my bicycle. I liked them, so I presume they didn't dislike me.
There's a bit missing from the story, though, because at some point you must have thought to yourself, I'd like to go to the Antarctic. And I'm wondering how that cropped up.
It was April of my final year, I think, when they obviously were searching around for someone to change dog food. I'd gone to Scott Polar probably 3 or 4 times a year because I liked the lectures. I felt it was no different from staying in Westmorland.
And you were skilled or qualified to consider the dog nutrition because of what? What have you done for them to hire you, so to speak?
Obviously, I read zoology. Alan knows I got a first because I can pass exams and I'm not clever. I was quite a good climber, so it was a fairly natural appointment looked at from the other side. Mm. And I'd been to Iceland and Lapland chasing birds in my student days. And I don't think there were many other applicants.
You've been actually to Iceland with Peter Scott, haven't you?
No, but I've done a lot of rocket netting with Peter Scott. And I went to Iceland between his two journeys. Oh. And I knew him fairly well, yeah. That bit in the book's wrong.
Okay, fair enough. This is Ellery Anderson's
book. It's okay, I knew Peter Scott well, and I'd texted geese for him and think that sort of thing.
Yeah. So how did you two gentlemen meet?
We met on the Visco going down, I should think, Julian. I don't think I met any other FID until we actually got on board the...
I think that's right. Ship. Mm. We didn't have a preschool meeting.
I remember we, somehow or other, we were all gathered together on the quay, waiting to go on to the Visco, and someone took a photograph, I don't know whether from a newspaper or what, and so we were all herded together. And that's probably our first meeting, really, yes.
At Southampton?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
In the late 1953?
Yes.
September or October? September.
September, I should think, yeah.
Had you not had any training at all before you went?
Oh, I had had meteorological training at the RAF school at...
Stanmore,
that's right, yeah. A month's training in meteorology there.
But had you either of you had any training to deal with the conditions in the Antarctic?
Oh, I don't think so, no.
A dog whip from Ray Ady. But I did, just narrowly, I spent a lot of time, and I can't remember whether it was in the term time or just afterwards, must have been term time, going to the research establishments about the dog food and Bovril and going round the factories and getting good advice from very, very experienced nutritionists.
So
preparing myself.
Where did this concern about the dog food arise then? Was it FIDS had FIDS come to the conclusion that the dog food wasn't good enough? Or?
I don't know. Clearly the Transatlantic TAE was on the cards. Clearly the dog food, which has been unchanged since 33, 34, 35, mm-hmm. was thought to be inadequate. Whether people like Frank Elliott had complained, I don't know. Colin Bertram, who was then running the SPRI, certainly was conscious that dog food needed changing, but I don't know where the spur for my the appointment as dog physiologist, which sounds pretty stupid in your passport, came from. I don't know.
But it was definitely, the work was commissioned by them, it wasn't your idea.
The dog food was certainly commissioned. The other two, the changing the breeding, which came later, and merging the workup, were my ideas.
Right. Did you brought those to the interview, did you, as suggestions?
Certainly when later we went to the... during the summer I'd done a lot of work, and then I was made to write a précis for the governor called Arthur.
Yes.
Yes.
Faulkner's governor.
I've got that. Clearly, I'd put those three projects together by November, let's call it, 53. A, nutrition. Not the breeding. I don't think I got into the breeding, but the work output, because I came down with some very sophisticated electric equipment to measure the work output, built by Saunders Rowe.
Right.
And that, I think, was completely my own idea. I claim it anyhow.
Just one thing about the Bisco that we went down on. She was not registered to carry passengers, so we all had to be enrolled as supernumerary seamen, and we got paid a shilling a day or something for that.
Did you have to work your passage?
We had to scrub decks and things like that, yes. Paint ship. But we did that anyway on the other ships as well. But it was not an expedition boat, it was that we were sailors.
Yeah.
A very good master, Captain Johnson.
Bill Johnson.
Bill Johnson. Yes.
Very good master, as I'm merchant marine, not captain.
Mm-hmm.
A very good navigator, but a very good humane dealing with us silly boys.
Yes, yeah, indeed.
What was your thinking about him, Alan?
Oh, I thought he was a great man, yes. He had a sense of humour, I know that. There was one, I don't know whether he had everyone, but sometimes he had people in to lunch, Julian. One or two people.
I don't remember that.
I seem to remember going to that, and he was joking with the chief engineer and
Digger,
so on.
Digger.
Yes, Digger. and I knew what he was saying. What are they having for food today on the bases? And I don't know whether he could make a suitable reply to that. Yes, he was great, and he used to be keen on his exercise every day, walking up and down.
Good, that's right.
So many times, didn't he, Julian?
I'd forgotten that.
Mm-hmm.
I got to know later Tom Woodfield. Who have you interviewed?
He has been interviewed. Yes.
A nice man too.
Yeah. Did Bill Johnson like his booze?
I don't know. Don't know really.
He certainly didn't drink too much.
I wouldn't have thought he was a great drinker, no.
Very surprised if he was. Northern Irish, as you know, but a good master of a merchant ship.
He was known as Kelly, you know that?
No.
Because he'd been employed for a long time, I think, on Kelly's coal boats.
Yes.
Which ploughed between
Liverpool and Belfast,
yeah.
What was were there any eventful moments in your journey south?
Not sure. We did a crossing of the line ceremony. Yes, where we all had to be captured and painted and so on, and plunged into a
canvas
pool of water. Yeah.
It was a happy,
yes,
quiet,
it was a good thing. Yes,
chipping decks and the sun.
Mm-hmm. No, the things I remember are seeing dolphins coming alongside and flying fish. We called it Cape Verde Islands on the way down, and then to Montevideo. Mm. We didn't go ashore in the Cape Verdes. We stood off, and boats came alongside with bananas and things, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
And got bananas. Very nice.
What was your first view then of the Antarctic when you first began to see, sense you were getting close to it?
Yes, I think the first sort of inkling was seeing big flocks of Cape pigeons and other seabirds flying along near the sea. And then the first sighting we had of a rock or so on was Deception Island, which looked as though we were going straight forward to a blank rock cliff until we went through the narrow bellows opening into the Whalers Bay. And after that, I'm not sure. It was, there were ice-covered hills around, but a lot of blackish sand.
Deception was a ghastly place to look at. Mm. But then tell the story about the...
Well, you had an unfortunate job to do, didn't you, there?
Yes.
Sorry, the...
The death.
Yes. While we were there... a man shot himself. I think he'd been the base leader, and something he'd received in the mail had upset him, and he shot himself somewhere near the base hut. And Captain Johnson and his officers and some FIDs, the deputy base leader, and so on, were holding an inquest or a court of inquiry. And in the midst of them doing that, a little cabin boy from the Bisco called Hatch, young Hatch, was wandering about in the base hut and came upon the very light pistol, which all the bases had one for sending very light pistols, and either unthinkingly or accidentally pulled the trigger. And, of course, the gun went off with a loud report whilst this inquiry was still going
on. And nearly set the hat on fire.
I set the ceiling on fire, yes.
We were digging a grave.
We were outside digging a grave in the hard, frozen soil, not getting very deep down, and someone had the bright idea of lighting a fire, and they got a lot of old packing cases and lit a fire in this bit of grave that we'd managed to dig. It didn't melt very much of the soil, but it did produce water from the ice, and so each time after that we dug in a pickaxe, we got splashed with dirty water. Our faces got all covered in dirty water, which made for merriment all round when somebody got splashed.
And I think the interesting thing, it didn't affect us at all, did it, that the chap had killed himself?
No, it did not strike us as a tragedy, which obviously it was. I think we were too young and inexperienced to consider what it might have meant.
Mm, I think that's right.
Did you sense a pall over the base, though, psychologically?
I don't know. I think we didn't see all that many of the base members. No. Do you remember seeing very many?
No. We weren't there very long, 3 days.
Most of them, I think, were probably leaving to go to other bases, and there were new people coming in who had not yet taken over.
Mm. In psychology, it was not a non-event.
Yes.
Which is the most odd.
To us, it was. Mm.
And then you travel further south and wound up at Hope Bay.
We went next to Admiralty Bay.
Admiralty or Sydney, yes. Yes, Admiralty Bay, yeah.
To Admiralty Bay. Mm. Did we take on some... No, we didn't take dogs on from there, but we delivered mail. That was our main reason for going.
Mm. And stores.
But... And probably to take one or two people off who were going elsewhere. Mm. Then we went to Hope Bay.
And then we lost an admiration for the Falkland Island crew. The sailors on board were magnificent.
Yes, they were. Yes, they were.
How do they demonstrate that? What did something happen which they cope with really well?
Just that they seem to be able to handle the boats and the what do they call the thing?
Scow.
The scows.
The great big heavy scow weighing 5 tons. Single derrick. They were just very, very good. Mm. And when the derricks snapped or they clambered up the derrick by themselves.
And doing the unloading of the ship and so on.
Brilliant scene.
Very good, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What were your first duties at Hope Bay? I guess you had to do some building, didn't you?
We took on board, I think, we must have taken on board from Admiralty Bay, Johnny Raymond.
Yes.
It was a great carpenter. And he went with us to Hope Bay, and we already had on board, I would imagine, timber sections and loose timber and lots of rapid setting cement.
Yes, that's right. Commando cement?
Fondue, that was it. We had gallons and gallons of that stuff in tins. Which all had to be transported up to the hut, along with the food stores, the coal and everything, didn't it? And we began fairly soon, Johnny began fairly soon to build the sledge workshop, which was an extension of the main hut. And I helped certainly with that, with mixing cement and whatever else they wanted anyone to do. I helped quite a bit with that. It was an apprenticeship for me in building work, because I'd never... One of the terms he used was we put these cement pillars down and then laid baulks of timber across and then other things of timber across them which had to be nailed in. And this particular type of nailing was called stitching because it went in diagonally, which was a new term for me.
So were you not sleeping in the hut at that point, Julian? Were you camping?
I had it easy. I think before we went to Hope Bay, I was landed at Joinville Island.
You came into Hope Bay and went immediately to Joinville Island.
Record. So I was let off all this rebuilding. Spent 6 weeks or 2 months on Joinville?
Yes, you were introduced to dog sledging on...
By two experts.
Joinville with Ken Blakelock and...
David Stratton. And John Stanley. So I had it easy. So my first 6 weeks, 2 months were sledging.
Was that sledging, did it have a purpose? What were you collecting?
Joinville Island hadn't been surveyed, although Shackleton got close to it, and the map was thing. And our main aim was to collect all the rocks there. I don't know why, and make a complete map. And so it was summertime, and we had a leisurely journey, but we sledged to every single rock output when Sandring collected the rocks. And two very, very, they'd just done their long journey. David and Ken were brilliant handlers of dogs. But we had it easy, it was summertime. We sledged a bit, we played bridge, had some food, chatted. Just easy summertime.
Was the rock collecting to do with this, the plate Teutonic theory?
Looking back on it, and later, we were clearly measuring the North Pole on the rocks on our long journeys, because I recorded, Alan, very clearly that when I was taught geology at university, the plate tectonics wasn't accepted as a theory. But I now believe Ray Eady, although he's not given credit for it, spotted it was likely. So we were certainly collecting rocks and later measuring the magnetic orientation of the rock in situ. Whether we did Joinville, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. How did you take to sledging?
Loved it. Loved it. Easy. Is that right?
Yes, yeah. It is surprisingly easy.
Yeah.
Easy. Had you had much experience with dogs before you went south?
Only I kicked dogs and I'd hunted fell hounds with on the fjord. But I'd not seen a husky, no. But it was fun. They were just lovely, happy dogs. It's very easy. But particularly when you're trained by Ken and David.
Mm. Did you end up with your own team?
Ken left me his own team. That's not quite true, but I was the only person who officially had a dedicated team.
Oh, so they were mixing and matching, were they, and you were swapping teams?
I don't really know, and my team wasn't clearly the best individual dogs at all. Brindle was a runt of a dog who snored a bit, do you remember?
Mm.
And there was another dog who they thought was a bitch. But it was clearly I was the only person who meant to have the number ones.
Really, anybody could drive any team, couldn't yeah. they? As you say, you had number ones, but I think most other people weren't allotted a team. They took whatever there was.
That was the very interesting thing, particularly Bill Anderson. We were all, except Dickie, were expected to sledge and like sledges, and you didn't have the best team, the best tent. It was very much a communal thing. We all did it.
I mean, there were some occasions when two people went out with, you know, and went over to Deuce Bay and so on, and they took whichever team there might be.
Mm. Which doesn't lead to the best dog driving, but it's very good for morale.
Mm.
So the dogs, presumably the dogs had all had to respond to the same instructions, did they?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you probably picked up the instructions in the Bass are different from Greenland. they're going north and south, the left and right have transfigured somewhere along the line.
Oh, really?
Haven't you heard that story?
No, I haven't.
Only
there is, I think, quite a bit of difference in dog leaders.
Yes, but Alan, just if I may, what I was referring to is quite good. That we used to say left urra and right auk auk.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
And the in Greenland, it's the opposite way around. So somewhere, either in the 30s or in the 50s, the people who like Bingham and knew about dog forgot which was left and right.
Must have been in the 30s.
Probably in the 30s.
Because I think a lot of our sort of history background came from Bingham, didn't
Bingham,
it?
Bingham did come from Bingham, but he might have got muddled up as a yes. old man like you and
yeah.
me.
Mm-hmm.
But it worked.
No, but individual leading dogs, I think.
Yes, it varied a lot.
Could be quite different. We had a dog at Halley Bay called Kate, and she was a magnificent leader. She never went wrong. But I've known other leaders who wouldn't respond immediately, would take a long time, you know, to do.
Mm.
Mm. And how you get over that, I'm not quite sure.
Patience.
But, yeah. Mm.
You, Alan, your first work with dogs was actually shifting stalls, wasn't it?
To get
the stalls up to the hut.
Mm.
That must have been a fairly tough, I would have thought.
It was good. It was good training. Probably I didn't realise it, but it was good training and it was good instruction for me to show that the dogs could do that, do things like that. And we used to bring up quite big loads of boxes and so on, or sacks of coal, and turn around at the top and then go straight back and bring another load up. So we had the hard work bit coming up to the hut, and then a jolly ride back with the dogs enjoying the run, going back down to the beach again.
May I ask, did you find that technically difficult, learning to drive dogs, or was it someone who helped taught you, or the dogs taught you?
Well, someone taught me, obviously. Usually it was Brian. Most of what I remember, it was Brian Kemp who was teaching me at that time. And he was a very easy, good-going teacher. And it's a simple business, really, and you just get used to it with a bit of surprise that the dogs take any notice of you. I mean, occasionally they get into a tangle or a bite, don't they? You get an odd dog who's got it in for somebody and starts off to want to fight, and you've got to stop them.
This is my main impression, as opposed to the written stuff. We found dog sledging with huskies easy.
Mm.
Clearly they made mistakes and we clearly got a bit fed up.
Mm.
But we found it...
It is.
Easy.
It is, yes.
That sounds stupid.
You're the first people to sort of make it that blatant.
I think so. Occasionally you could want them to have a bit more power and get a bit more move on, but... it depends on... I think they do occasionally get a bit bored.
Yeah.
And they may need a bit of something to... They might need just a rest.
Yeah.
And then go on again.
Occasionally a bit bullshit and go the wrong way, but no, we all found... I think the huskies are difficult dogs is crazy. They're easy dogs.
Mm.
And I think dog sledging is you've got to learn 200 years and go with Hansel and Amazon. We found wrong. We just all sledged.
One of the things that... was a little bit of a surprise, but you soon get used to it, is that I did one trip with Ken Blakelock up to the first depot, and one of the dogs started to defecate and wanted to stop, and you're not allowed to let them stop. So they have to keep going and do their business on the run, which I hadn't even thought about before.
Ken was a master of driving, but what I find so interesting, none of us know how good we were compared to other people, because you surveyed, so we have no idea who were good with dogs or bad, but it was easy. We loved it.
You're giving the impression these dogs were always obedient.
They were, yeah, 99%.
Most of the time,
yeah. Yes. I mean, 95%.
You couldn't trust them. You had to watch them.
Yeah.
You know, or to stop, hadn't you?
Yeah. I'm going to elaborate a little bit. Mm. I loved sledging on frozen ice, where you had to zigzag.
Mm.
And I had quite a good leader. Spark was quite a good leader, not a top-class leader. Mm. It was Yap or Kate. Mm-hmm. And you could steer him within a foot.
Yeah.
Exactly. And he was 20 yards ahead, which way to go. And the dogs would go, and so the sledge would go rather like driving a HGV.
Mm.
But no problem at all. You just enjoyed it. And then the second year, do you mind if I just go on?
Yeah, please.
I was with Slim Willis, because we were all in Deuce Bay, and my record show, I did 190 miles by myself. And I think I must have taken my dog team out with whale meat or testing, and taken a dog team out, 9 miles, killed a seal or collected some coal or so, and come back. And it wasn't an event. You just, it was like going for a bicycle ride. Does that sound?
Yes. Yeah. That's what
you just and you obviously tether the dog. Presumably, I put a spike in. I must have killed a seal. The dog's laid down. I presumably, with a hook, put the seal on, and maybe two seals with the feet onto the sledge.
Mm.
But it wasn't difficult.
Well, I did a bit of sealing in Deuce Bay. I don't know whether I did any with you, Julian, when I was there, but with Ian Clark, because we were very short of seal at Hope Bay, and Ian and I went out and got as many as we could and dragged them into bottom of Last Hill, and then they were taken across to Hope Bay. Which relieved the meat situation for a bit.
I was probably on Joinville.
Mm. But on a further occasion, Ian and I and someone else hitched up most of the dogs.
Yes.
I don't know how many there were, 48 dogs or something, onto a sledge and took them all over to where the seals were in Deuce Bay.
Mm. It's very interesting, this. We've both never done this conversation before. Mm. But how we all... The dogs took to us, let's put it that way.
But you had 48 dogs on one sledge?
I think it was 48, yes. There'll be a record.
With two people?
Yeah. And you were taken over to the Hudson's Bay to pick up seals, or...?
No, to feed them there.
So you then shot the seals for them?
Yes, or they were already there, we'd already shot them.
Right.
And it... we hadn't anything left at Hope Bay.
I must have been on John.
And we... Right, so. No, I think it was probably a bit later than that, I'm not sure. But otherwise, we would have been... We'd had to feed them on pemmican, which we'd soon run out of.
Right, and it's not a good food.
Mm.
This is a cue for Julian then. Come on, Julian, tell us a bit about your work on dog diet and how you went about assessing the success of pemmican.
Just on dog diet, it wasn't very difficult. As a student at Cambridge, you were very well taught. You probably saw three of my lectures were Nobel Prize winners, and I liked my lectures. I always went to lectures. I was fascinated. And clearly there was massive work wrong. Before I went, there was a person called Professor Worden at Huntington who ran the thing which now all the people are discrediting. And there was the Something Done laboratory around accredited. And there was a very wise woman called Dame Something Wooderson, who had been in Buchenwald, who advised me. So I had marvellous teaching before I went south. And I knew the food was wrong, and I knew that Bovril were making a profit of second-rate seal meat. And so I knew that there was something very wrong with the diet, and I went round with all that, and it wasn't very difficult. It's almost O-level stuff today.
Well, how was the bad diet affecting the dogs?
We didn't know. Clearly, later we found they were having protein poisoning in the urea, massive urea poisoning, and they were getting ulcers in their mouth, which I don't think we know remember why. But it was a second-rate food. Bovril pemmican, now Bovril disappeared, was clearly not good beef. It was washed-out beef from Argentine. There was no vitamin supplements fed. They hadn't been changed for 40 years. There were a lot of stories of dogs getting deprived and running down on bases. It was an inadequate diet, and so my main aim was to show it was inadequate, urea poisoning, vitamins, and then change the diet, which I must have done by telex or something. So the first year we got the whale meat, we got a first nutrient down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the second year a different thing. But I was given complete trust by Bunny Fuchs to suggest the diet change and to add the carbohydrate, add vitamins, take away quite a lot of the protein, try and get the fat absorption out. It wasn't really very difficult.
What techniques were you using to measure the dogs, the way the dogs were dealing with the food they were getting? I think you were gathering urine, were you?
Oh, yeah, I certainly tested the urine and showed an awful lot of nitrogen was coming out.
How do you collect dog's urine?
Easy.
Easy. It freezes.
Julian, originally, John, Ron Mottishead and I built... I don't know what you would call it, a dog's urinal.
Yes. A pee station. For me, was it, or just generally? For you, Julian.
And we did it with sheet metal, a sort of big square funnel with a grid on top. And the dogs were supposed to stand on the grid.
I completely forgot this.
And do a wee-wee, which would be collected underneath in a suitable vessel, and we would give that to Julian. Only the dogs wouldn't cooperate.
No. And so, you complained bitterly when I boiled the feces.
Hang on, we'll come to that in a minute.
So
let's deal with number one
next,
first.
The next thing for collecting urine was to hang around with a bucket of some kind. And when they cocked their leg up at the base hut corner, you collected it as it came out and gave it to Julian.
It's the most interesting thing, how we worked together. It was very much a team thing.
Yes, it was.
And the second year, very impressed that Derek Clark was in charge of the puppies.
Yes, he was.
We all shared the duties. It was very interesting. Mm.
It does sound a bit hit and miss, your tactics, but I guess it worked. They gave you enough urine to work with, did they?
Wasn't hit and miss. Wasn't hit and miss. Okay. It was precise. Well, the urine was... But you can get frozen urine. It's not difficult.
Yes.
If the microphone's not off, it's much more difficult to collect urine from one's wife when you're looking after her.
There were some casualties in your in the pursuit of your knowledge, weren't there? You did find yourself having to slaughter some dogs.
Repeat the question, please.
Did you have to slaughter some dogs in order to conduct your research?
No, yes, but we did kill dogs.
There were some dogs born who were...
Runts.
Runts.
And we killed him, we shot one or two. What killed him was one of my lovely dogs who got glaucoma or the eye and we shot.
Yes, yes.
Yap, we didn't shoot.
No.
But certainly we selected the pups. Derek was very... Derek says he will drown the dogs, which was very noble of him. Mm. We were very selective the second year.
Mm. Yeah, but he talks about, actually, the doctor, I forgot the name for a second, Manby? The doctor injecting the pups?
Massey.
I'd forgotten that.
Yeah. No, what I meant was that there's a reference in your dog papers, your research papers, to the fact you were studying the stomach contents of dogs that have been killed.
I'd forgotten that. I probably did. I was fairly thorough.
Yeah.
The actual absorption of the solids was very bad indeed. And I was conscious of that, and so I was measuring either the wet faeces or probably the stomach contents.
Yes, you mentioned collecting the faeces as well. That was presumably a pleasant job.
They objected, I boiled it, but it was okay, never mind.
The rest of the fids objected.
And it made us smell right.
I don't think so. No, I mean,
it's exaggerated.
Again, it was there, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The stuff was there.
We all cooperated.
If you wanted it from a particular dog, obviously you waited until you got it, I can't remember.
It was very much collective. Mm. I wasn't treated like a silly scientist.
I think we had some old cooking trays. Old aluminium cooking trays to collect it in.
Yeah. Mm. It was a collaborative effort.
Mm-hmm. How did you go about composing the new dog food? You had to put together a little menu, didn't you?
Clearly, I decreased the protein, I increased the carbohydrate. I changed from beef to whale meat, which was later gone back because much cheaper, whale meat was much cheaper. I added milk powder. I presumably faxed it or radioed it back to Fuchs, who talked to Professor Worden and the Dunn, some Dunn, the John Institute. And they trusted me, I think. I must have recommended it the first year, and probably the second year changed it slightly.
Was it still manufactured by Bovril?
No, we changed straight away to Bob Martin's.
Right.
And called Nutrican. Mm. And it's been changed. My success has improved it. Mm-hmm. But I think that the great trust we were given by the head office, we weren't fighting for changes. I think they just accepted our advice.
Yeah. And this was the food that was given to the dogs on the TAE? And
They used the first, as far as I know, the first lot of Nutrican, which appears to have improved a bit. And the second lot was after the TAE, it seems to have improved a bit more. But you never quite know.
But it was a positive result, anyway.
Well, so they say. We think it's better. We're certainly better.
You were, of course, were doing metrology on your 1 month's training, Alan. And I wonder just how those early observations went. Were you nervous?
No, I don't think so. Obviously, you can read a thermometer and it only reads one figure. You put it down on an observation sheet. The more difficult part to get right was the clouds. How to look at the clouds and how to classify them and how to estimate their height. I don't know whether the today's meteorologists do the same kind of thing, but it purely on observation. We also learned how to send up pilot balloons, as we called them, which gave us wind speeds at upper levels. Those balloons we had to follow through a theodolite. And at Hope Bay, we had a little shed where the theodolite was in a hatch in the roof. And we had a telephone set, telephoning back to whoever was inside the hut, giving him the readings and he would plot the courses of the balloons. So I would say it's a fairly straightforward business once you get just used to it. And I imagine, well, a certain amount of the same kind of thing goes on today, probably by the Met Office and by other people, of course, who send in reports to the Met Office.
Do you remember any extremes that you were measuring?
Wind speed?
Not.
What was the wind speed ever recorded?
Oh, the wind speeds were sometimes over 100 knots or 100.
At the base.
At the base. And they used to hit the base very suddenly sometimes. And they would blow for, 24 hours, sometimes a bit longer.
It was very windy at times, and I suspect, I've looked at the Met records, I reckon it was well above 100.
Yes, often above 100. Sometimes we would be experiencing these strong winds at Hope Bay, whilst at Deuce Bay they would be in comparative calm. So it... I think it gave the more experienced meteorologist a clue that this was an orographic wind.
I can't use long words.
I'm not sure whether orographic's the right term, but related to the
topography.
To the shape of the topographical
wind. It came
wind,
down
that's right.
where we slated. It was a windy base.
Yes.
And you lashed everything down, sledges down and everything.
If you didn't, things got blown away, yes.
And was the hut lashed down as well?
Yes.
Oh, the hut was permanently lashed down, yes, with wire, cable. And of course, we had to go outside whilst this was going on to read the thermometers. And I think someone got lost during one of these.
I don't remember that.
I'm not sure now.
Bill Anderson.
It might be in his book. But someone did get lost for a long time. But
luckily we didn't have a fire later, but a fire would have wrecked that base
in
10 minutes.
Yes, we are lucky because we did use oil lanterns, didn't we?
Yes.
Paraffin oil lanterns,
which
could easily blow over and... start fire.
It was a windy base.
What kind of precautions did you take to avoid fire?
Well, we just had buckets of sand here and there.
We didn't have a fire drill ever.
No, we didn't. Fire extinguishers and one or two buckets of sand, as far as I can remember.
We weren't very good on health and safety.
Did you have a night watch?
There was always a Met man every night, yes, who stoked up the fires to keep the hut warm during the night, and of course did the
observations
every 3 hours.
I think what's coming over is from both of us how easy we found it, not difficult. The whole thing of taking Met observations or driving dogs, it was. Cushy life.
Yes, I think some people, Joe Lewis and some others, were radio hams.
Yes.
And they were allowed to use the radio, and so they did some radio hamming when they were on night duty. But I didn't. I didn't do touch the radio. I know what I did used to do during the night. I used to make myself scrambled eggs. With egg powder.
I probably didn't do nights, did I? Because I wasn't a Met man.
No, so you didn't have scrambled eggs.
I didn't have scrambled eggs. But this is it's different from so many of the stories. It wasn't a difficult life.
No.
Does that ring bells?
Well, but you did do some quite long journeys, didn't you? Which presumably weren't comfortable all the time.
One thing about the winds. When they eventually stopped, all the dogs would give a tremendous howl. Do you remember that, Jimmy?
Yes, yes.
And it was a beautiful sound.
Yeah.
terrific. 80 dogs howling.
Just on disasters, let's do the three disasters. I lost my tent, which is in Bill's book, probably stupidly. According to my diary, it was 10:30 a.m. and there was daylight, and I think it was April.
Is this when a piece of ice broke the bamboo pole?
Well, so the books. I've got very little recollection. Certainly the tent went, and certainly Slim Willis and I were dressed ready the tent to go, and certainly we crawled for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes in a... But you couldn't see a thing, so the wind must have been 80, 90, 100 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. If you were on your hands and knees, you couldn't see your feet.
Right.
So it was clearly very windy.
Where were you crawling to, Julian?
Towards
Towards
the
presumably
base.
Probably we knew where the other tent was. And Slim and I bumped into each other, but clearly you couldn't begin to stand up. And we were lucky to... But we didn't bother about it. That was a really interesting thing, and you didn't blame me. But that was clearly quite a close shave, if you look at it. Mm. Then, a year before that, or the same year, Alan was sledging with two other people the year before, when the dogs drowned, and I was in the hut at Deuce Bay, and I heard the howl, and we went out next morning, Ken and I, to pull the sledge out. But Alan saved John's life. You've heard that.
No, please. Alan, tell me your version, then Julian can have the bits noble to mention.
We set off from Hope Bay probably about 9 o'clock in the morning, got over to Deuce Bay, and we were going to head over to the hut at Viewpoint where Julian was. This was my first experience of sea ice. I'd done sledging around the base and so on. This was my first experience of sea ice. And we met a tremendous jumble of ice. And we would go for a few hundred yards and then be stopped. Whichever way we turned, there was something blocking our way. And so we had to hack our way through walls of ice and find a route and go up little hills and then drop down into tank trap things, knock our way out. And we were doing this for what seems to be hours on end.
Probably 3 or 4 hours.
Three or four hours, I would think. And it looked as though we might have to pitch camp and carry on next day. And this
getting
was something...
It was getting dusk.
Mm, this was something that the others didn't want to do, and certainly... I was the new boy. I didn't know whether I wanted to do it or not. But we came out of this jumble onto a stretch of flat ice heading towards Viewpoint, more or less straight. I was apprehensive about this new ice, but again, I was the new boy, the others were experienced.
Why were you apprehensive?
I didn't think it looked particularly safe, to be honest with you. It was slushy. It was slushy. Anyhow, Johnny Standring and I had the leading sledge. Joe was following by himself with the second sledge, which had a slightly heavier load than the one that we had. We set off, heading towards Deuce Bay.
Viewpoint.
To Viewpoint, I'm sorry, yes. We'd gone about 250 to 300 yards, 250 to 300 yards, when the sledge suddenly broke through into water and came to a sudden halt. We tried to get the dogs to pull it out, but it was too much of a dead weight, I think they wouldn't pull it. It also, the sledge, didn't drop on an even keel. It was slanted. It was further in underwater at John's side of the sledge, the left-hand side, less so on my side. John, as it stopped, immediately threw off his skis, which was not a good thing to do, but what he was hoping to do was to go forward and get the dogs moving. But once he'd taken his skis off, he was putting more pressure on the ice, and he sank through it a couple of times up to his waist in water. And the dogs suddenly wanted to go to the left, towards the open sea, and I am not sure why they would want to do that. Either I think there was a seal swimming about, and that attracted them, or they were getting the scent of dogs at viewpoint and wanted to go straight towards them. Anyhow, they were pulling strongly to the left, and each time they gave a pull, the sledge dug further underneath the slushy ice. John, as I say, went through the ice several times. He got round to the front of the sledge, onto the more firm ice where I was, but he was still breaking through. I threw him my sheath knife and told him to crawl, get down on the ice and crawl. And he did that, and without my knife, he couldn't go forward because he wasn't getting any grip. He was just floundering backwards and forwards. But with my knife, he was able to come towards me. We shouted at Joe, who was still at the beginning of the ice. His sledge had gone straight through as soon as he got onto this ice. His sledge had gone straight through. There was no reply from him. We couldn't hear him. He couldn't hear us. Obviously couldn't hear us. We must have been too far away from him for him to hear. I started to ski back towards Joe, and Johnny Standring crawled, pushing before him a pup tent. I was carrying the other pup tent with me on skis. And I got to Joe, and he was releasing his dogs. He was able to release his dogs. We both tried to pull the sledge with a climbing rope, tried to pull it back onto the firm ice. We couldn't move it. So we set off, we caught up with John, we got off this dodgy ice back into the jumbled ice that we'd been travelling through all day, and we walked through that to viewpoint. Although it was dark, there was no moon, but it was brilliant starlight, and we could see where we were going. As we went along, two or three dogs caught up with us, and so we walked to Viewpoint Hut. I don't know what time we would get there, Julian.
Probably, I guess, about 8:30. Okay. But
sorry?
You had 3 hours, 4 hours walking.
We had, yeah.
Had we gone to bed?
What, on the way?
No, had Ken and I gone to bed?
I think you had gone to bed, yes. Yes, because Ken Powell was with you.
Yes, Ken Powell was there, yeah.
Ken was in bed, and he got up and made some tea, and Julian dressed Johnny Standring's hands, which were blistered with frostbite. Do you remember that, Julian?
Very much so.
You put some, I remember, was it some riboflavin?
Can I pick up story now, Alan?
Mm.
So they'd arrived at the hut, let's call it 11 at night. We'd heard, Ken and I had heard a shout, a shrill, 3 or 4 hours before. Mm. We clearly heard the dogs drowning and didn't recollect. We probably guessed you'd camped or something, and went to bed. And let's assume we turned the light out, or a lamp out, and then suddenly these three very, very wet. John was completely soaked. And his hand, I don't know if you know, in Scott's book, there's a picture of Scott's last journeys, Doc Lang. Well, John's hand was much worse than that. We should have taken a photograph.
Yes.
Mm. And my recollection is I spent the whole night with John's hand under my armpit.
Yes.
We probably had the coal stove. The hut was this sort of size.
Quite small. Yeah.
Quite small. Mm. John was in pretty bad way.
Yes, he was. He was. I mean, apart from the fact that his hands were frozen, he was also absolutely wet through.
We must have undressed him and put him in a sleeping bag or something. Mm. I think we probably didn't take much notice of Joe and you. You were quite happy to look after yourselves.
Although we were wet through crawling about on the snow, but not anything like we went wet through as John Stanley was.
And we probably made you cocoa on the coke stove.
Yes, you certainly did. We had something.
So the dogs drowned. What happened? Were they pulled under by the sledge?
No, we missed out that little bit. I gave John Standring my knife and he cut the main trace with them on.
So all the nine dogs?
So all the nine dogs were tied together. And as soon as they were released, they ran off straight into the water.
It was all drowned?
They obviously were drowned.
And none survived.
We could hear them howling in the water.
Mm-hmm. But Joe, who was a very able swimmer, Joe, we think, came from a water polo team in Tilsley, released his dogs individually.
Well, his sledge was not underwater, and the dogs weren't underwater. They hadn't put their feet through or anything like that. So, in fact, I'm not sure whether I helped when I got back to release the old one, I'm not sure. But obviously they were just standing around. They weren't keen on going anywhere else.
But all nine dogs were saved, weren't they, of the second team? Mm. So we lost one complete team.
And that team died because they were tied together and they tried to go in different directions, I guess.
I think I've got some notes about this, which I've sent you a copy, I think. I'm not sure if they'd been released singly, whether, in fact, it would have made any difference. They were intent on going that way to the left, straight towards the sea. And I think once they were in the sea, they wouldn't have got out of it, because each time they'd have tried to get onto this ice, it would have given way.
Very thin.
Mm. I think, in fact, that some of them were trying to do that, but they were not making the same effort at the same time. They were pulling in different directions.
But anyhow, the night was, I don't know, it was a pretty gloomy night. I'm not sure whether you got warm anyhow.
Yes.
And then Ken and I went out next day and picked up the second sledge.
You were able to get the second sledge. You were also able to retrieve my camera from our sledge, but there was no chance of you getting it out.
The sledge.
Mm.
So we found the second sledge, interesting.
You did. Mm. And we could even see it later on. I remember walking up to Cheese Rings, as it's called, and look out into the sea, and the sledge was still there in a frozen waste.
That was quite a close run thing.
Let's stop and take a short break.